This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, what Florida tells us about where Trump's immigration crackdown is heading. The landscape of immigration in the U.S. has changed dramatically since President Trump started his second term. In his first days in office, he signed an executive order to speed up deportations, deny protections for sanctuary cities, and boost staffing for ICE and Customs and Border Protection. Since then, there have been ICE raids all over the country, and detentions have surged, doubling or even tripling in some states compared with the same period last year. And in July, Trump signed a sweeping tax and spending bill that included billions of dollars to expand detention centers and ICE operations.
During his campaign, he promised a historic immigration crackdown. And we truly are seeing it happen in real time.
That's Jasmine Garst, senior immigration correspondent for NPR. She's been capturing how these policies are playing out on the ground, talking to people in communities most affected by this crackdown.
I've been covering immigration for a while, and I've never encountered this level of utter fear.
And lately, Jasmine has been spending a lot of time in Florida.
Florida officials have said, we want to be the tip of the spear. To me, Florida is like this crystal ball into what is coming nationally.
In January, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was the first to deputize the State Highway Patrol to enforce federal immigration law. Florida has also been quick to expand detention centers and offer direct commercial flights for people who choose to self-deport. ICE arrests of people without criminal charges or convictions have surged in the state in recent months. I sat down with Jasmine to talk about what she's been hearing in Latino communities across the state and why she says that what's happening in Florida is a sign of what could unfold across the country. We started by talking about who is being targeted for detention and deportation on a national scale.
They've stated a goal of 1 million deportations in the first year. And so, you know, there's this rhetoric that is, you know, we're taking the worst of the worst, right? Mm-hmm. The rapists, the criminals. That was what was promised during the campaign. But the numbers just don't show that. You know, obviously, these numbers fluctuate all the time. But there's close to 60,000 people in detention right now, mm-hmm. and around 72% don't have a criminal record. So we're not seeing that play out in the numbers. Mm. There's a whole body of criminological studies that show that immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, commit crimes at a lower rate than U.S. citizens.
Right.
And so, yes, like when you promise that you are going to deport millions of criminal immigrants, in order to keep that promise, you have to cast a wide net.
I mean, I should say that the Department of Homeland Security refutes that statistic, that there's 72% of people who don't have a criminal conviction. At the same time, though, as you have pointed out many times in your reporting, many others have pointed out in their reporting, they are not providing evidence to the contrary. They're not providing other documents that would
Absolutely.
Say.
I mean, we at NPR, we have spent hours crunching the numbers. I mean, there are numbers that are available, and it just, what they're saying does not reflect in the numbers, you know?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I hear, you know, administration officials say, but also people who support what the administration is doing on immigration, is they say that these people came here illegally. They committed a crime by coming here. Now, just to say, coming to the U.S. to seek asylum isn't against the law. There's a legal process for that. But depending on how someone arrived, whether they've been deported before or what state they're in, there can be charges associated with how and why they're here. But what do you say to that line of thinking, that they broke the law?
I mean, I think what's being questioned here is due process and how people are being treated, right? I mean, there's this idea that immigrants don't have due process, and that's incorrect. Immigrants in the U.S. do have due process. So again, I think what we're talking about in part is like how we treat people, right? Mm-hmm. And how the U.S. is treating, you know, people in detention and families who oftentimes don't have a record.
Right. What are people due in our legal system?
Right, exactly. Yes, correct.
And why should that be applied differently for people who have legal status here or not, right?
I think it's important to also say it's not just people who are undocumented. Like, the goalposts keep moving, mm-hmm. right? Like, I've been speaking to people who had, like, a stay of deportation, which is you check in once a year with immigration officials and you tell them, you know, you haven't committed crimes, you have a job. I mean, we're seeing, like, increasingly, we're seeing cases of that it's not just people who are undocumented. So it becomes a slippery slope.
A stay of deportation or removal, as Jasmine just mentioned, is when a non-citizen who's been ordered to leave the country is given a chance to stay and appeal their case. But Jasmine says even with this stay in place, people are still vulnerable to being detained and deported. That's what happened to an evangelical pastor living outside of Tampa. His name is Maurilio Ambrosio. He has 5 kids, all of whom are American citizens. By all accounts, Ambrosio was following the rules.
He was a pastor and a landscaper, had a stay of removal. So he was checking in with immigration once a year. They knew where he was. No criminal record. On the 13th year, he got picked up a couple of months ago. He's been deported.
He was sent back to Guatemala. His neighbors were shocked, and his wife and children are devastated.
Pues mis hijos están muy tristes por eso y pues como que el mundo se les vino encima, se les terminó y pues...
That's his wife, Marlene. She told Jasmine that for her 5 children, it's like their world ended. Jasmine spent time with the family shortly after he was detained.
I joined them for church service. The daughter has taken over church duties and I left my bag in the church and just went out to do some stuff. And I came back in and the church was empty except for his 12-year-old son. He was lying in a pew crying. But he said like this one thing to me. He was like, I want to touch my dad. And I don't know when I'm going to be able to do that again. Maybe never.
I wouldn't know what to do without him. He's like a best friend to me.
On top of the emotional impact of his absence, there's a very real financial effect on the family as well. Ambrosio's wife and some of his kids have had to scramble to find work. Jasmine says this is a common story in the aftermath of a primary earner being deported.
3 of the kids have entered the workforce. They're working in construction, ages 20, 18, and I think 16. And the 14-year-old is thinking of dropping out of school to join the workforce. Those kids' lives are derailed. Mm-hmm. There's not going to be college. There might not even be high school for one of them.
Another theme that's come up in Jasmine's reporting from Florida is racial profiling. There have been widespread complaints across the country, largely from Latino communities, that people are being stopped or apprehended by ICE based on their appearance, not because they were breaking a law. DHS has denied these claims, saying its enforcement operations are highly targeted and that agents know who they are targeting ahead of time. Jasmine has been following the story of a couple from Fort Lauderdale who believe they were racially profiled. They told her about their experience while they were out fishing one day in a park.
She's breastfeeding, he's fishing. It's like a Saturday or Sunday. And someone from the parks department approaches them. And the parks agent says, "Can I see your fishing license?"
The man shows the parks agent his fishing license. The agent then asks for the man's driver's license, which he didn't have because he's undocumented. The man's wife says that the agent then immediately called ICE. Her husband had 2 traffic violations on his record and a dropped drug charge, but she told Jasmine that she doesn't think that's the reason they were apprehended that day. Just to say, Jasmine did not reach out to ICE for comment on this specific incident because the family wanted to remain anonymous.
The wife was telling me that she feels the reason that ICE was called on them is because they're Latino, but not just Latino, they're indigenous people. You know, these are Mayan people. And she said to the agent, she told me, "I'm breastfeeding. Why did you call ICE?" And that the agent said, "Because I can." Mm. They are immediately taken in. It's probably like one of the most emotional interviews I've done. They get taken in, they're detained in separate rooms, and she doesn't know where he's being detained. Mm. But suddenly she hears like a knock on the wall and she realizes it's him. And during this detention, which was close to a day, they start communicating by knocking on the walls. And
is her baby with her?
Yes.
Okay.
And that she's being held for so long that I didn't know this because I don't have kids, but that when you breastfeed, you get dehydrated or you're at risk of dehydration. Mm-hmm. And she starts to get worried, what if I pass out because I'm breastfeeding this baby? And then he disappears for a couple of days. She doesn't know where he is. She's completely desperate. And she just goes into a state of such like hysteria that she has to be medicated. And he finally calls her like a couple of days later and he's like, I'm in that alligator Alcatraz place.
Alligator Alcatraz is the official name authorities in Florida have given this new detention facility. It opened in early July to handle overflow from a rapid rise in detentions, while the pace of deportations remained relatively slow. The facility is located on an airfield in the Florida Everglades. Governor Ron DeSantis has said this location will make processing and deporting more efficient and that it should serve as a warning.
This is as secure as it gets. I mean, if a criminal alien were to escape from here somehow, and I don't think they will, you've got nowhere to go. I mean, what are you going to do? Trudge through the swamp and dodge alligators on the way back to 50, 60 miles just to get to civilization? Not going to happen.
According to the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times, around 750 people were being held at this detention center as of mid-July. Officials have said the facility can hold up to 3,000 detainees. And even though it's not yet at capacity, there are widespread reports of inhumane conditions.
It's an extremely hostile environment. I am getting reports of people who are detained who have gone a day without eating, who have been sleeping on the floor for weeks, insect-infested cells and communicable disease and reports of no air conditioner.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has said that Alligator Alcatraz is a model for more state-run detention centers, and that sites in Indiana, Arizona, Nebraska, and Louisiana are under consideration.
I think if there's one thing that I have learned from weeks being in Florida is the expansion of this detention machinery and detention industry with very little accountability about who is going in and how they are being treated when they're in.
In the case of the family Jasmine met, this week, Jasmine learned that the husband has been moved to another facility. His wife is at home with their baby. She's been fitted with an ankle monitor and was told that she has 3 months to leave the country. She is terrified to go outside. Jasmine said that a lot of people in her reporting have told her they feel this way.
What I'm seeing is like a level of fear and paralysis. I don't think I've ever encountered this level of hiding, of like windows drawn, of utter fear. And there's something, I mean, I think like the fear also is kind of the strategy, right? We haven't talked yet about the detention center in El Salvador, about Sicot, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Where they sent around 250 migrants who we now know overwhelmingly didn't have criminal ties to this, I hesitate to call it a detention center because it's a concentration camp in Central America where we know they were tortured. There is not a single migrant that I have spoken to in the last few months that has not mentioned this incident to me and said, I need to leave now because I could get sent to this black hole in Central America where we know they torture people. And that is like a very strategic fear move.
It's which, like, just to say, the administration is saying very clearly also to people. I mean, there are those commercials that are running with Kristi Noem, who is literally saying this to people. You should choose to self-deport before we find you.
Leave now. If you don't, we will find you and we will deport you. You will never return.
Yes. I mean, there's so many people who I've spoken to who have said, I want out. I cannot stay here any longer. Deport me. And I think that's the thing. It's so difficult to deport a million people, that one of the pillars of the administration has been to push self-deportation.
Right, right.
And so increasingly I'm talking to people, not just in detention, people in general, who are saying, I'm too scared, I'm too miserable, I want to get out.
Mm. I mean, one thing that we've heard the administration say and point to as evidence of their success is that illegal border crossings are in fact down, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about what story you think is behind those numbers?
I mean, the crossings are down. I mean, in many ways, it's been also the enforcement of Panama and Mexico and the Mexican government, which during the Biden administration, Biden officials were meeting with Mexican officials and the Mexican National Guard was cracking down. And border crossings are historically down.
Right.
I think people are just afraid to come to the U.S. I mean, if you are in Venezuela or Guatemala and your uncle is being held in a detention facility for months on end and your auntie is hiding, you might think twice about coming to the U.S. Yeah, it's been very successful in terms of diminishing border crossings. I mean, I think what a lot of people are starting to feel uncomfortable with is how that enforcement is taking place. And also something we haven't talked about is the economic costs of it.
Yeah, tell me more about this, because I know that this is an angle that you're very interested in and that you've been following closely in your reporting.
I mean, I am yet to find an economist who is not warning that this is going to have a negative economic impact for a couple of reasons. Like, first of all, that woman who, you know, the fisherman's wife who has been hiding for weeks behind closed doors, she's not really doing a lot of grocery shopping. She's not pumping gas into her car. She's not going out with a friend. She's not injecting money into the American economy. And this is something that, you know, is playing out in a widespread way. So, you know, this idea that immigrants don't pay taxes and, you know, and don't, immigrants spend money, they inject money into the economy. So that's one angle. But the other angle is that how much it's affecting the labor force. Mm. And Florida, again, Florida is a really interesting place to look at. In the last couple of weeks, I spent a lot of time with farmers in Central Florida. One of them told me he is going to decrease his crop production to 30%, not by 30%, to 30%. Mm. Because it's just, he said, listen, like the local folk who are undocumented, who I've been working with for 30, 40 years, I can't risk hiring them or they're gone. And the visa is just really expensive, the worker visa.
Right.
And so I'm truly between a rock and a hard place. And I hear this over and over again from farmers. And I always feel like a little uncomfortable talking about people as just labor. But I think it is worth noting that economists are saying we are shooting ourselves in the foot here.
Mm-hmm. And it's not a small part of the conversation when you look at states like Florida or like California, where so much of the labor force has until now relied on people who are living here undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Has the Trump administration said anything to the effect of how it plans to mitigate economic impact?
I mean, with the case of farmers, it's like super interesting because, you know, definitely agricultural lobbies have said, listen, this is really affecting us. Every farmer I spoke to said, you know, like, we need to figure something out. And like, farmers who voted for this,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The Trump administration a couple of weeks ago said, you know, gave a hint that they were going to stay off farms and off agriculture with raids. And then they kind of backed out of that and said, no, we're going to continue. And so it'll be really interesting to go back to Florida during picking season and planting season.
Which I'm sure you plan to do.
I do.
What do we know about public opinion at large at this point?
So, I mean, what we know 6 months in, there was an NPR poll recently that showed that 43% of Americans feel the administration's immigration policies are making the country safer. But as far as ICE enforcement goes, the majority think it's gone too far. And I think from what I can see from the polls and from interviewing people who voted for this in many cases, Americans, it's not part of their political landscape for masked agents in unmarked cars to pick people up. I sense from conversations with Trump supporters behind closed doors that there's a deep, deep discomfort with how this is playing out.
I wonder if you've thought about, like, what is the administration's capacity for outrage? Like, public outrage. Because from what I remember of family separations in the first Trump administration, it was largely public outrage that pushed the administration to change policy. Do you see that on the horizon here? Do you see some kind of tipping point happening?
You know, we talked about paralysis earlier in immigrant communities. And something that I also am seeing, which is not being talked about a lot, is paralysis in American communities. You know, white, sometimes Trump supporters or not. And I think there's this idea that, you know, this is not who we are. You know, like, we are not a country where people wearing face masks in plain clothes and unmarked cars go and take people away and people go missing for 2 and 3 days. There's this idea that at the core, this is not an American identity. Of course, you would have to, you know, also speak to an African American or a Muslim American, and they might tell you, no, this is exactly who we are and always have been. But there is like a core sentiment that this is not who we are. I remember talking to one of the pastor's neighbors, and he was very shaken. He voted for this administration. He was shaken. And he said to me, are you hearing other cases like these? Of people being taken away who don't have a criminal record. And I think there's like an identity crisis almost of, is this who we are now? It seems to me that we're at this crossroad between either this becomes the norm or we, you know, like people are like outraged. But right now we're like standing there and it feels like in conversation with people who voted for this and who didn't, there is that. There's a sense of paralysis of, is this happening? It's happening, right? It's happening.
Jasmine, thank you really. Thank you for staying on this reporting. And thanks for talking with us about it.
Thanks for having me.
You can find Jasmine Garst's reporting for NPR on Apple News. We'll link to it on our show notes page.